My guest in the studio tonight first performed a Mozart piano concerto at the age of 9 in the Sydney Opera House. He has a string of international prizes and scholarships under his belt. He's performed with orchestras worldwide and even performed for royalty and presidents. He's often described by his musical peers as one of the finest artists in the world. He's one of the few Australian classical pianists who readily crosses over into jazz. Simon Tedeschi, welcome to Now's the Time.
Lovely to speak to you, Frank.
Simon, a Mozart piano concerto at the age of 9 at the Sydney Opera House. You must have had a very disciplined upbringing. Tell us how one has that sort of ability at such a young age. What sort of practice and regimen are we talking about?
Certainly a lot of discipline, a lot of you tend to neglect school, you neglect sport, and you certainly neglect a social life. So I suppose in many ways the story of a young pianist at that age is in some ways a story of sacrifice, and I'm no different, but it's never been boring, I'll say that. And as you said, I got to play at the Opera House, and I still remember that performance as one of the calmest and most centered experiences of my professional life.
One of your jazz cohorts, Ian Cooper, once told me that the secret to his regimen was that he wouldn't get breakfast of a morning until he'd done half an hour of practice on the violin. I'm wondering how extreme it was for you to be
Mine
so.
was worse. I practiced before breakfast. When it was still dark and cold, I would get up and practice, and then I would eat breakfast. Then I'd go to school where I'd practice for quite a lot of it. Then I'd come back home and I'd practice some more. And yeah, it was tough. And I wouldn't necessarily want to put my kids through it, but it pays off, and I can play the piano now.
Well, you can play
Thank heavens for
the
Medicare.
piano, all right. And of course, what I didn't mention in the intro was the fact that you played for Pavarotti at the age of 13. Now, what do you recall most from that experience?
Well, whenever I travel down Macquarie Street these days and I see the impassive building of the Intercontinental, I think of that. And I was 12, nearly 13, and a small one at that. And I went up to the Presidential Suite, I believe it was called, and it was not only Pavarotti himself, but a bodyguard, a cook, and a girlfriend, and a lot of pasta. It was everything that you would imagine it to be.
And a lot of red wine, I'd imagine.
I'm sure there was, and I played for him. He was very, very complimentary. He told me my left hand wasn't present enough, and even back then, I thought to myself, "What? You're a singer. Leave me alone." But yeah, it was incredible. I'll never forget it.
When you say he made comment on your left hand, is that something that stayed conscious with you for years after that? I mean, obviously someone of the stature of Pavarotti.
Yeah, I was even thinking this today, not necessarily to do with Pavarotti, but I was rehearsing with the Amiga Ensemble for this gig on Sunday that I'll tell you about, and thinking my left hand isn't present enough because I'm so strongly right-handed, and I'm playing this Brahms trio, and Brahms is just so weighty and just so chordal, and I really need to voice my chords properly. I mean, you hear the word voicing with jazz players a lot, but you don't really hear it that much with classical players, but voicing is so important, how you play a chord.
Now, of course, our great sportsmen, you hear stories about how they continually question themselves and what can I be doing better? How can I improve? Is that something that you focus on to reach the heights that you do?
Certainly, but also a sense of resignation that, you realize that you can never play as well as you possibly want to, so almost give up reaching for give up trying to be as good as the music because it'll always be better, and just do your best. That took some years, and it takes maturity to realize that, I guess, as a child and as a teenager, you're trying to get better and better, and I'm still trying to get better, but I know my limits, and now I'm trying to make myself happy as opposed to necessarily others, and as a result, I think the performance is more honest.
Well, that brings me to my perennial question in that how do you measure the success of a performance personally?
Oh, look, Again, and as you would know, there's so many variables there. It's a difficult one. Generally, it comes down to a lot of it comes down to mood, how I'm feeling on the day, and preparation. They're the two things. Preparation will help mood a lot. Have I communicated with the audience? Have I said what I wanted to say? Rachmaninoff said that there was this point in every piece, this one point, and you either got it or you didn't. And I think there's some truth in that too.
You've performed on so many of the world's great stages. Do you still have nerves prior to your performances, or any secret fears that you might like to share with us?
Oh, some performers suffer terrible stage fright, some suffer none at all. And I'm in the former. When I was younger, I suffered the most hideous stage fright. Hideous. Really terrible. I'm so bad that one can't imagine, and yet somehow I persevered. I found that over the years, from about 17 onwards, it never went away, but it got a lot better. And I can control it now, whereas I couldn't when I was younger. But what's interesting is I often read or hear about musicians, and it's the other way. As they get older, they begin to realize their own fallibility. They get nervous then. But as a kid, they don't know what's going on. But I knew what was going on. I knew I had to, win or be good as a kid. But as I get older, I feel, well, it matters to me less. And I'm a better performer and musician as a result. So it's interesting how it's happened to me. But yeah, still, I definitely get nervous if this concert tomorrow and also on Sunday, I'll be feeling it.
Kevin Hunt, he really has influenced you significantly, hasn't he?
Kevin's influenced me in every way, not just music, but it would never be just music because he's such a enigmatic sort of guy. I mean, he's so lovely, but there's this depth to him as well, and there's this depth in his music and his improvisations, which I'm still constantly trying to tap into, and he lets me, which is beautiful because a lot of guys would be defensive about their art or their sound, and he's not at all. So it's beautiful. Our latest ABC CD is called Woodlands, and we're very proud of that. I am a scholar of the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust, as is Kevin, I believe. So we have more of a connection there, and we're both North Shore boys. So we're playing for our own crowd, so we probably can't do much wrong.
The reason I chose this particular track, Simon, is because you've taken the arrangement of Keith Jarrett here, Someone to Watch Over Me. There must be something very special about this that attracts you.
This is from Keith in Tokyo, if I'm not mistaken. It's absolutely stunning, and Keith has, in his own unique way, taken an incredible tune and made it deeper and with more pathos. So it's incredible.
You must be one of the most awarded artists, Simon, I've had on this program. Can you name one award that was the most pivotal in regards to the success of your career to date?
It would have to be the Symphony Australia Young Performer of the Year, because that's when it all started for me. That was sort of a rite of passage in many ways. I think they probably gave it to me for persistence because it was first stage, nine pieces, second stage, concerto with second piano, third stage, concerto with state orchestra, fourth stage, concerto with state orchestra. And it was like the Olympics, needed it every year. And I eventually won with the Ginastera Piano Concerto number 1, which is an Argentinian work. And it's pretty fearsome, but that is certainly when things began to really take off for me. So I suppose that's the one positive side of competitions.
And what year was this?
1998.
That's when people started to really take notice.
Yeah, that's when I really began to cement my reputation, and I got a manager and all that stuff. But it's something you never really forget. Melbourne Concert Hall. It was a really huge event, and it was not just that year; it was many years in the making.
The digital age, Simon, just diverting a little bit here, has influenced all levels of the music industry, from how music is made right through to how it's delivered to the consumer. Does classical music, does that industry embrace the digital age as much as other genres, do you think?
Yes, classical music is. I mean, I heard Martha Argerich, the great, great pianist. She did a download-only version of some massive concerto with Claudio Abbado conducting. Download only, and I thought, wow, I've never heard of this before. That's serious. And of course, with digital media, there are concerts like Berlin Phil, which are filmed, and you can watch them if you're in Galagenbone. So, yeah, classical music has really—it's changed drastically, even over my lifetime. I'm a relatively young guy, but I'm sort of at that crux, I guess, that of the old versus the new, and I saw it all change, and I've had to embrace it. And there are people who are, born, 15 years ago, who have known nothing else. So it's, I feel like a bit of a pleb.
So you've watched that change and now you're part of it and can take full advantage of it.
Certainly. I mean, there's amazing things like CD Baby. Kevin Hunt told me that, I think it was Andre Previn said, "No, you got to own your own recordings now. That's the way it's done." Or was it Herbie Hancock? It was one of those. And Kevin was like, "Hold on a sec, you've made so much money out of recordings." That's what he thought. But it's changed drastically, and I'm still learning about it. I'm still learning about the download thing. I mean, I was even postulating the idea of selling USB. What do you even call them? Memory
Oh, the memory
cards,
sticks,
memory sticks. But yeah, it's still the vast majority of people who listen to classical music are quite elderly, and so it's still the CD. It's
yes,
still very much the CD. The CD is anything but dead.
that's right. Now, before we were talking off air about the fact that you had been based in Boston for 6 years and you've recently returned to Australia to base yourself here. And of course, I guess the digital age allows you to do that to a certain degree too, does it not? In that you don't really have to be, it's like the jazz musicians today tell me you don't have to be in New York to be a jazz musician. And I guess the same concept can apply.
Certainly. I mean, a lot of my colleagues, I have not done it, but a lot of my colleagues who teach, they teach over Skype. I mean, I find that incredible, quite incredible. Yeah, I primarily made the decision on a lifestyle basis because I'd been away for 6 years, and I was, how it is. It's you go away and then suddenly it's like you become popular because you're away. And so then I became, people were like, "Well, we want to give him more gigs now that he's gone." And there's only so many times you can take United Airlines back from Boston to Sydney. It's a real bleep of a flight. So I wanted to base myself here and travel there as opposed to the other way around. And it was a very good decision.
Yes, oh, that's good. Well, it's great to have you back.
Thanks,
Now,
Greg.
your new album, Gershwin and Me, is out on ABC Classics. Did you get permission from your old mate Kevin Hunt to release this one?
I certainly did. Kevin, in fact, I said, "Kev, look, I want to improvise over summertime. I wanted to get your advice." And he played me the Gil Evans arrangement of it, if I'm not mistaken. And he just wrote some ideas for me. And in the end, I discarded all of them, but it really helped get me there because I still look to him as a real luminary, as a starting point, an incubus for ideas. Even though I'm much more of an ideas man in terms of the improvisatory thing now than I was 10 years ago, he's really the guy that fires a lot of it up. The summertime I came up with, that the very first part of the track starts with a Doria scale in the left hand, and I tried to go for a really spare sort of sound, and then I went into arpeggios, and I hope it's convincing, but Kevin is pleased with the arrangement, and he would be very blunt with me if he was not.
Simon, in relation to jazz pianists now, what other jazz pianists have had an influence on you, and do you ever feel you need to seek inspiration from them?
Oh, look, the guys who and the women who just blow me away. I mean, Ralph Sutton, I think he's as good as there ever was. Errol Garner, I just continue to marvel at him. In terms of in Australia, of course, Kevin, Paul Grabowski is incredible. Mark Isaacs, I like Mark Fitzgibbon from Melbourne a
Oh,
lot. I
yes.
think he's incredible. But I listen to him and I just think, he's in a different stratosphere to me, even when I'm listening. So that's a beautiful but also quite a daunting feeling.
You probably discovered the art of improvisation very early on, having played so much piano, but at what stage did you feel you really wanted to explore jazz seriously?
Well, it's really funny what's happened. I'm going to go backwards for you because now I can only improvise in jazz style. I can only use hip voicings. I can only use extensions. I can't improvise as a classical in a classical style.
Is
It's
that
the
right?
strangest thing, and yet classical music is my lifeblood. It's my reflexes, and I find it quite an anomaly. I think it was Wynton Marsalis who said that it's really quite impossible to do. To be great at both. And if anybody can say that, it's him.
Yes, that's
He's as
right.
close as they come.
That's right. He's won Grammys in both genres, I
He
believe.
has. But I think what he was sort of saying is that he's jazz royalty, and it's really where it comes down to reflexes, and my reflexes will always be Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. And I think it's like conditioning for an athlete in a way. It's muscle memory. It's a different type of learning.
Speaking of reflexes here, you're playing two pianos on Django Reinhardt's Nuages. I mean, how do you do that?
Look, the way it was set up, it started like most things with Coop as a challenge. He told me I couldn't do it, and that was a mistake. And we got the two pianos at right angles to each other, which made it quite, well, for me, quite easy. And I could play. I basically had to be able to reach both pianos and work out where the keys were in relation to each other. So then I played Nuages, and seemed to be a big success. This was a live performance, so it was just straight.
Definite barriers, really, between the two musics we're talking about, classical music and jazz, but I feel they may be breaking down somewhat. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the last 20 years or so, there's been an enormous convergence, if you like, classical music. I mean, ever since of course there's Art Tatum, but then really ever since people like Oscar Peterson came along with his technique, which was as great if not greater than a classical player, you really I mean it's very you'd be hard pressed nowadays to find a jazz musician who did not at least have a sound knowledge and or an appreciation of classical music. The really great jazz and classical artists have a world of view. They've never really been sort of tunnel visioned in their approach to music. But yeah, more than ever, it's huge now that jazz musicians have a very strong classical bent, and they have classical training. Almost everyone I see. I mean, it's almost passé to say it in America because it's just everywhere. I mean, Günter Schuller in the 1970s, with the third stream thing, and I mean that Boston is just huge for that. Everyone is following in his footsteps. So, and there's at New England Conservatory, there's a program called Contemporary Improvisation, which is distinguished from jazz. They really make clear to distinguish it from jazz because, and nothing is off limits.
George Gershwin is obviously a major influence on you as well, and I guess in a lot of ways there are some similarities in what he did and what I guess you are trying to do, in that, he really bridged musics, coming from a very traditional style and really creating something like Porgy and Bess, America's great opera. And in a way, you're sort of doing similar things in that you're able to come from that classical background and cross over into jazz and bring improvisation even back to classical music on occasion.
Yeah, I'm trying to. I mean, what I love about, I mean, my connection with Gershwin is not easily understood. I suppose I like to say that, I mean, my mother's maiden name is Gershwin. That's the funny thing. But there's, if there's any relation, I'm probably closer related to you, Frank, than to George. But I like to say that my family were from Eastern Europe, and they could have easily ended up at Ellis Island, but they went to Circular Quay instead. And George's family from that generation, probably two back, ended up in New York. And his family originally from St. Petersburg. And so you can hear that Russian Rachmaninoffian sound, that sort of rhapsodic sound in, say, Rhapsody in Blue. But what I love about Gershwin is he opened up the African American blues sound and brought it into white man's music. You can hear the Cuban, I mean, the Gershwin Preludes, which are on my Gershwin and Me disc, they're Brazilian dancers. I mean, what a man. And I really wanted to include on this CD, which I have, two Percy Grainger arrangements of Gershwin, because what you've got then is you've got a really quixotic Australian ethnomusicologist, great pianist, interpreting the work of a Tin Pan Alley great pianist from New York, played by an Australian pianist, 80 years later in Sydney.
It really brings home the fact of how influential that one man was.
Yeah, that's globalization for you.
That's right. Well, Simon, it's been just delightful having you on and chatting with you on Frank Presley's Now's the Time. Simon Tedeschi, thanks very much for joining me.
Lovely to talk to you, Frank.